Okay, welcome back. Let me turn on the recorder. Welcome back. Here we are, Web Yeshiva, Mishkan Tzipora, Mesechet Ta'anit, Daf Kaf Bet Omud Bet 22b. It's almost Purim. You know about Purim? Sometimes it rains on Purim.
Sometimes it snows.
Okay, but we'll talk about that today. Let's first look back at the Mishnah. Here's the Mishnah. You remember in this parak, all the Mishnayot are front-loaded. The Mishnah says, Ma'aseh sheyardu zkenim Yerushalayim la'areihem. That's already interesting. And I presume there's what to be said about that almost, I don't know, a Gadic feel. Right? The idea that the Mishnah begins Ma'aseh, right? In other words, it happens from time to time that the Mishnah does that. I'm looking to see, I just got this new book by Rabbi Yaakov Gnack of the Otniel Yeshiva. I'm sorry, I called him Gnack. That was his name when we learned together in YU. Now his name is Rabbi Yaakov Nagen. That happens sometimes, that people change their names when they come in Aliyah. Called The Soul of the Mishnah, which explores different agadic ideas in Masechet Ta'anit. But there is, unfortunately, nothing on this particular Mishnah in this otherwise rather comprehensive book, The Soul of the Mishnah. And I think it's an expanded version of an earlier Hebrew book called Nishmat HaMishnah. But I recommend this book. But the Mishnah says, Ma'aseh sheyardu zkenim Yerushalayim. And as the Chachamim had met in Yerushalayim, and then they were leaving. When you leave Yerushalayim, you are yored, right? Not just geographically, but you spiritually, you descend from Jerusalem to wherever you're going. And while they were doing that, the following happened. They gazru ta'anit al shenir'eh kimalo pi tanur shidafon bashkelon. They declared a fast because they saw a certain quantity of blight, the disease that affects the crops in Ashkelon. How much blight was there in order to cause this gezerah, the Gemara will discuss. Va'od gazru ta'anit al she'achlu ze'evim shnei tinokot be'ever ha'yarden. So some chachamim were going towards Ashkelon. Another chachamim were going to Ever Yarden in the almost opposite direction. And over there, there were two children that were eaten by wolves in Ever Yarden. And they, you know, because of these different calamities, they instituted a fast. They took these as omens, that a little spiritual uplift and rejuvenation was needed. Rabbi Yossi Omer, lo al she'achlu, ela al she'niru. No, you got the story wrong. It's not that they made a ta'anit because wolves ate two children. Just simply that wolves were seen. Just the very presence of wolves. This is connected to the Gemara we saw last time about chaya mahalechet. A band of wandering savage animals, their presence is enough to kick off the process. The next Mishnah says, Al Elu Matri'in B'Shabbat. And on the following, you can even make the declaration and sound the shofar and etc. even on Shabbat. Al Ir Shehikifu HaGoyim, a city which is besieged by non-Jewish troops, or Nahar, or if there's a kind of a flood, the adjacent riverbank is going over its limits and is flooding the city. V'al svina hamitarefet bayam, or a ship that is kind of rocked at sea, you know, that's about to go down. Rabbi Yossi Omer, le'ezra velo litsa'aka. That you call not in order to, you blow the shofar not in order to call out to Hashem in prayer, but you call a blow on the shofar because that was the siren. The shofar was also the siren that would be sounded in order to call your neighbors to come and lend a hand to bring the sandbags against the flood, or to stand guard against the invading marauders, or maybe to help those that are in a shipwreck. Ezra velolitzaka, right? That's the purpose of blowing. In other words, the quote unquote chilul Shabbos, you know, was part of the normal type of chilul Shabbos. You know, it's the equivalent of saying if you see someone, God forbid, get hurt seriously on Shabbat, you call Mata, you call Hatzalah, you call the ambulance, 911. Shimon HaTemani Omer Af Al Hadever. And also, if there is on Shabbat, you can sound the alarm if there is a pestilence that hits the town. Velo Hodulo Chachamim. But his fellow sages did not agree with him. Okay, now let's go to the Gemara.
A question though.
Yeah.
Why would, I mean, maybe we'll get to the Gemara, but Dever doesn't seem like a case that you could do anything in an active sense the way the other cases are. So
what would you think?
Well, I mean, that might be why Lo Dulo Chachamim, but I doesn't even understand why Ilech Achili would have said that. Like,
well, minutes, maybe he disagrees with this. Maybe Shimon HaTemani's disagreement with the Tanakhama is about both of these issues. What the purpose of sounding the alarm on Shabbat? So if we hold like Rabbi Yossi, the purpose of sounding it's an alarm. It's not a call to tshuva. It's a call for assistance. Ezra velo letzaka, right? So maybe he disagrees with that, right? In which case, you would blow it even for things that you're not calling. There's nobody to call for help if there's never. Wait, we're 22-bit. Hold on a second. I think I lost the file. Hold on. Let me get it open. So here we are in the Gemara on Kaf Bet Omid Bet. Here.
Right,
yeah, yeah, it's right here. I got it. Okay. It's the eyes don't work after a certain hour in the night. So Iboilahu. Iboilahu is a... What kind of question?
Clarification.
It's an information question. An information question. It's not an attack, it's an information question. The word bo'e has three meanings. If I had a bottle of whiskey for each time I've explained the three meanings of bo'e over the years, I could open a Adlo Yoda for Purim. Not that I'm suggesting, of course, that you send me a bottle of whiskey for Purim. Those of you that have seen me in person know I've lost a lot of weight recently by giving up the whiskey. But Iboilahu Ba'e has three meanings: to inquire, to require, to desire. People desire information. They ask an information question. They require the information. Therefore they inquire. So Iboilahu, Kimale Tanur Tfu'a, Odilme Kimale Tanur Pat. It's a rather pedantic few lines of Gemara. When the Mishnah had said that even if they see blight, how much blight? They see a patch of blight that's as big as the opening to an oven. Well, what does that mean? Like, what? rabbis of the Mishnah, why can't you just like take out a tape measure and tell me? It's a half meter by a half meter. Or even an amma by an amma. Right? But what is it? How big is the opening of an oven? Well, it's an interesting metaphor. Because wheat, what does wheat mean? This blight that's affecting the wheat. Wheat means bread. In other words, the wheat is used for bread. So we're going to give it in a measure that's relative to something connected to the process of making bread. And that measure has to do with the oven in which we're baking the bread. Of course, the oven that we're talking about doesn't look in any way like our ovens. You know, the ovens were these, it was more like, well, if you've ever been to like a pita factory or, you know, you did this in camp where you did it with your kids on camping trips, right? It was, you know, like a tabun is a con. Don't tell me. A tabun is a convex oven, right? You put heat and then you put the tabun on top. The tabun is like an upside down wok, and you stick the pita, the dough, to the outside of this dome, and it cooks very quick. But the ovens of Chazal were concave, right? They were like these little hollows that had fire underneath, and you took the dough and you slapped it up on the side on the wall of the oven, right? And because it was concave, right, like the underside of an upside down wok, right, it held in the heat from underneath, and the pita cooked very quickly on the side of the oven. And then with your that big spatula thing, you know, like the thing they bring the pizzas in and out of the oven, you could take it off as it was ready. So the opening to this oven becomes a kind of metaphorical size measure for how much wheat would have to be affected by the blight in order to declare a fast. But a Chazal, they want to figure it out exactly. So how much is it? Is it the amount of grain to fill the oven? Kimlo tanur tfua? Like, if you take the measure of an oven and you put all the affected grain in there and it fills up the oven. Now, of course, you don't put grain into an oven. You take grain, you grind grain into wheat, you knead it with water, you make it into dough, and then you put the dough into the oven. But if you were to put the affected grain, is it enough to fill the opening of the oven? That's how much you need in order to declare a fast for Shidafon. O dilme kimalei tanur pat. Or is it the amount of bread, or I should say dough maybe, made from the grain that's affected, that would fill an oven? One thing, of course, that the Gemara doesn't define is what? What's the one variable that we haven't figured out?
The size of the bread?
No, the size of the oven. All ovens were the same size? Clearly not. Right? So presumably we're talking about an average size oven, I guess. I don't know. So Tashma, so the Gemara has to answer this. Listen to this. Kimlo pi tanur. The Mishnah had said the amount, the size of the opening, to fill the opening of the oven. V'adayin tiboilehu, but nevertheless, we still need to answer. Kechisuya de tanura, odilma kidara de rifta. Right? Is the Mishnah talking about the bread that covers the oven? Or is it odilma, or maybe it's the would it be enough to make the dough that if you wanted to cover up the hole at the entrance? Or is it, does it mean to fill the tanur that you would like put the different, the lachmaniyot or the pitot in the oven, and that's what would be filled? So like, we don't know anything. Is it, do you measure it this way or do you measure it that way? And even if you measure it this way, if you're talking about the bread, are you talking about the bread arranged like this? or the bread drains like that, and the Gemara gives you a perfectly reasonable answer. Teku. What's teku? As we say in good Yiddish, Echresnit. I don't know. We don't know. It's a tie. It's a toss-up. When Eliyahu HaNavi comes, the first thing we'll ask him is this question. And he will answer it for us. Right? So the Gemara does not give, it only gives questions. It does not give answers. Right? You know the Agdon story about this Gemara. There are two brothers, Chosid and a Mesnagid. It happened in families that each went in their own way. Perhaps you know of families such as this. Right? There's a Chosid and a Mesnagid. And they're arguing about where, when Mashiach comes to our town, right? They live in a little shtetl in war-torn Ukraine. They live in a little shtetl in Galicia. Right? So when Mashiach comes, of course, Mashiach is going to come to our town, our little town in Galicia. Right? So when he comes, is he going to come to the Beis Medrash of the Misnagdim? Or is he going to go to the Shtibl, the Klois of the Chassidim? So the Chosid says, certainly he's going to come to us first. So the Misnagid says, why? So he says, you don't understand. When the Mashiach comes, if he goes first to Mashiach, you know, Mashiach starts off in Rome, where he's sitting with the beggars and the schleppers and the schnorrers and the Mitzoraim, the lepers. And he has to walk from Rome, or travel on his donkey, all the way from Rome to our shtetl, right? He's hungry. He's tired. He's going to get here. He's going to walk into your Beis Medrash. You're going to hakam a chaynik. You're going to want to know if there's shidafon in Ashkelon, how much bread would need to be baked from this affected grain, and what way should it be arranged in an oven to know that it has crossed the threshold for which we need to fast and sound the alarm. But if he comes to the Klois, you know what we're going to do? We're going to give him one of those lachmaniot. And we'll also give him a little schnapps to wash it down with. Where do you think Mashiach's going to want to come first? Certainly he'll want to come to us first. So there you go. The Gemara goes on. Yes. V'od gazru ta'anit al she'achlu ze'evim. The story about the wolves. Omar Ula Mishum Rabbi Shimon bar Yehotzedek. There are a lot of names of Chachamim here who are not familiar to us. You can keep a tally on the back of an envelope, right? There are a lot of names here that are not familiar to us from most pages of the Gemara. This is one of them. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehotzedek. If somebody wants to Google him, tell us about him. We welcome that information. Masse uvalu ze'evim shnei tinokot. It happened once that wolves came and devoured two children. Ve'heki'um derech beit harei. And excreted them. Meaning the babies, you know, were eaten and digested, and what comes out the back end of the wolves come out the back end. You know, the Gemara spares no detail here. Like, if I were to tell you, if you were to land from Mars and I would tell you, yes, every Tuesday night we gather to study holy religious texts. And you ask me, like, what did you study? So, well, we were talking about the wolf excrement and which body parts get passed through the wolf digestive system. The Martian might really think we really had been drinking some of that whiskey. So in the wolf excrement, ba'u ma'ase lifnei chachamim, v'tihiru et ha'basar, v'timu et ha'atzamot. Well, you know, the chachamim were sensitive to various halachic dilemmas. Like, they were sensitive to the fact that children had been devoured. And probably they took that as a sign of having to do tshuva. And they sounded the alarm. And maybe they even sounded the alarm on Shabbos. And they tried to rouse people to tshuva. But But there are also other halachic elements, like tumah v'tahara. In the presence of parts of a deceased body. So there's impurities that are involved. But not every part of a deceased body. So it's grotesque. I mean, last week we were talking about the keynote of Tisha B'Av. This is almost something out of the keynote. This is almost something out of Eicha. Right? So the flesh that passes through the wolf's digestive tract nevertheless is considered digested. It's no longer considered human flesh for the halachic purposes of being mitameh, of causing ritual impurity. But the bones, any bones that pass through whole, those are considered still human bones for the purposes of tumah v'tahara. And that's what the Gemara has to say about the Mishnah's case of the wolves eating the children. Rather distressing. Al elu matri'in b'shabbat. And on the following cases, which we saw in the Mishnah, they would sound the alarm even on Shabbat. Tanu Rabbanan, here's a braita. Ir sheh kifu anachrim o nahar. A city surrounded by a marauding horde, or the river rising and flooding the town on Shabbat, ve'chad svina hamitarefet b'yam, or a ship that's about to go down at sea, ve'chad yachid shenirdaf mipnei nochrim, and here the Brisa adds an element that we don't have in the Mishnah, an individual who is being pursued by non-Jewish no-goodniks, o mipnei listim, or by bandits, o mipnei ruach ra'a, or an evil spirit, a demon. Matri'in b'Shabbat. You can sound the alarm even on Shabbat. The chiddush of the Braisa is that this can be done even for a yachid, even for an individual. Va'al kulan, yachid rashai l'sagef et atzmot b'ta'anit. And for any of these, an individual can sagef et atzmot. He can afflict himself through fasting in order to get rid of the evil decrees. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Ein hayachid rashai lesagef et atzmo b'ta'anit. Rabbi Yossi said that an individual cannot afflict himself with fasting. Why? In other words, if there's some kind of trouble.
Is it Shabbat or?
Well, we'll see in a second. But in other words, in a case where they have not, where the Chachamim have not declared a ta'anit, and as if the Chachamim declare a ta'anit, so then he has to fast. But if there's something going on, communally or individually, the Chachamim have not yet declared a fast, so Rabbi Yossi, against the Tanakama in the Braisa, Rabbi Yossi says that the individual cannot afflict himself with fasting. Shema yitztarech labriot. Because maybe through afflicting himself through fasting, he will then become dependent on others. He'll be too weak. He'll be too weak to take care of himself. He'll be too weak to work, to support himself. Ve'ena briot merachamot alav. And maybe people won't, you know, be able to take care of him. They won't be passionate. They won't be... So Amar of Yehuda Amarav, my Ta'ama de Rabbi Yossi. So why does Rabbi Yossi say this? Why does Rabbi Yossi say that the individual can't take on these fasts? Dichtiv Vayihi Ha'adam Lenefesh Chaya. Genesis chapter 2, that the man becomes a living being. Nishama Shinatati Bacha Hechiyeha. It is our responsibility to guard our lives. I mean, it's interesting that we bring this drasha instead of bringing just a more explicit pasuk of shmartim ma'od l'nafshotechem. You have to. There's a responsibility to take care of your health, to take care of your life. But because of that, a person can't take on some kind of excessive fasting. So. This question of when, let's say, when a group is in danger, when a city is in danger through flood or something like that. The idea that an individual who is not directly connected should not be allowed to... Please note, it doesn't say not allowed latsum. It says lisagef et atzmo. What does sagef mean? David, when I asked... What?
Isn't it asceticism?
Yeah, yes, it's asceticism, but it's kind of like it's like extra type of taking on some kind of abstaining, like, abstention,
like Rabbi Yehuda Hasid's people that would like roll around in the snow, things like that.
Right. You know the Rambam. I mean, we've talked about this in the past. I mean, many years ago, we studied. I mean, David, you might have been the only one that was around back then, but many years ago we studied the Rambam's Shmona Prakim, which is kind of the home address for the anti-ascetic attitude in Judaism. The Rambam was definitely not into those types of, lashing oneself or, you know, rolling around in the snow or things of that sort. I mean, the Rambam probably didn't encounter snow that often. Does it ever snow in Egypt?
Probably rarely.
Yes, rarely. So this idea of lissagef, to afflict oneself through fasting, Rabbi Yossi says that is not allowed. The Tanakhama allows it. Rabbi Yossi does not allow it. Because, you know, maybe you'll get sick, you won't be able to work, you won't be able to care for yourself, and then, you know, you'll what benefit would be gained by you being put into that position? So everyone agrees that when a city or an individual is, you know, faced with mortal danger, there's no obligation for another individual outside of there to fast on behalf of that city, unless the Chachamim have declared a fast. But to voluntarily take on a fast, there's no obligation to do that. So the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yossi, the machlokus is whether or not a person can volunteer to do that or not. So all of this seems to go against the Gemara we saw on Daf Yud Chet Omid Bet. Remember that Gemara? The Gemara talks about if rain falls in one city, but it doesn't fall in the adjacent city, the idea that the adjacent city fasts in sympathy or in connection or in solidarity with the afflicted city. So if that's the case, right? So how could you say that you can't do that if it doesn't affect you directly? So there are a number of different answers to this question. Rashi, on our Mishnah, Rashi says that the cities around, the surrounding cities around the city in trouble, don't fast because of the other city's trouble. They're not fasting in solidarity. They're fasting for themselves. Right? In other words, if there's a drought in a nearby city, that affects me as well. I think we mentioned this. We saw this Rashi over there. What does Rashi there say? He says, because it's all effect. Like we see now, like the supply chain. Right? How does the supply chain affect me in Efrat? The supply chain dilemma? Because we live in it. Even then, they had an idea of the kind of global village. It wasn't quite as big as our global village. Right? But if there's tsaris in one place, it's going to affect me in my place. Right? If there's tsaris in the adjacent town, their economy is going to be hit. If our two towns trade with each other, that's going to affect what's happening in the shuk in my town. So my fasting when they are afflicted is not some kind of voluntary piety. It's because I feel my own existential, my own existence is somehow imperiled. However, the other Rishonim disagree with Rashi. And they think that it's okay to fast in sympathy for someone else. But, you know, tomorrow's a fast, by the way. although it's a very unusual fast. It's not a fast like any of the fasts that we're talking about, about rain, but it is a fast that, at least in its origins in Megillat Esther, how does Tanit Esther fit in with this idea of a sympathetic fast?
It was on Pesach, so the whole question.
Forget the fact that Tanit Esther is not when the biblical Tanit Esther was, but it's.
No, I'm saying it's relevant in terms of the Shabbat issue, also.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Wait, wasn't there some discussion whether she was allowed to do it? It was on Pesach.
The Gemara discusses it. But it's a type of sympathetic fast. Esther says, she's the one in trouble. She's the one whose neck is on the line. She knows what happened to Vashti. Right? So she tells Mordechai, tell them all to fast for me. Right? Because I'm in existential trouble. By going into Ahasuerus, I'm putting my neck on the line. So, that's an interesting kind of biblical precedent here. So, the Ramban says that fasting for someone else's troubles is connected to what type of tzaris is threatening them. Our Brisa is talking about a kind of immediate mortal danger, right? The ship is about to go down at sea, right? The invading troops are surrounding the city. The river is rising, and, you know, like that joke, you know, you go up to the roof and you're waiting for God to save you. In those cases where there's an immediate mortal danger, the people in danger can't fast for themselves, right? In other words, the Chachamim have not declared a fast. And those people, what we're going to tell the people, we're going to tell the people in the ship that's going down at sea, don't eat, don't drink, you should be fasting now. Right? So therefore, the people in the adjacent town, or the people that are aware of what's going on, they fast voluntarily as a way of, I don't know, what do you call that? By remote, or, you're taking on an act of piety so that it should be to the merit of the people that are in trouble. The Ran says that when you have these cases of immediate danger, the type of fast we're talking about is not the normal cycle of fasts. The normal cycle of fasts are the Monday, Thursday, Monday fasts that we've talked about previously for hitting different benchmarks in the rainy season without getting enough rain. Instead, these are kinds of ongoing consecutive fasts where you would fast, you know, every day from sunrise to sunset until the trouble passes away. So you can't force the surrounding cities to fast, right? I mean, it's not reasonable to tell cities that aren't directly affected, you have to fast every single day. So in that case, he says, that's the machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yossi, right? The Tanakhama says that individuals in the nearby cities are allowed to voluntarily fast every consecutive day until the trouble passes. And Rabbi Yossi says, no. He says, you can't. Why? Because, and here the Ran points to the word lissagef, right? Normal fasts are not sigufin. They're not torturing yourself. They're not beating yourself up. They're not, you know, whipping yourself, lashing yourself, right? A normal fast is a normal type thing. But to fast every single day, pardon me, the way that Ramadan is, right, that's sigufin, right? And sigufin is not, even though like halacha thinks it's okay to like tell people, don't eat today. Don't eat today and don't eat again next Thursday. But the idea of fasting every single day in a row, that's not an idea which the halacha is comfortable with outside of extraordinary circumstances. So if you're doing it merely voluntarily, you can't take that on. Those are some ideas about how to understand that Gemara. Now the Gemara goes on. Iboy lehu lo hodulo chachamim b'shabbat, aval b'chol hodulo Odilma lo hodulo klal. This was David's question a few minutes ago. When he said, oh, I'm sorry. When Shimon Hatemani had said for a plague, you could sound the alarm even on Shabbat. They disagreed. So what do you mean they disagreed? So does it mean lo hodulo chachamim b'Shabbat, that you can't sound the alarm for dever, for plague, on Shabbat, or even during the week you don't sound the alarm for dever? So Toshma, Tetanya, matri'in al hadever b'Shabbat. The Brisa says that you do sound the alarm for dever on Shabbat. Ve'ein tzorech lomar b'chol kal v'chomer on a weekday, if there's dever, if there's a plague, you can sound the alarm. Rabbi Chanan ben Pitom, another name that you don't hear in every line of Gemara. Talmido shel Rabbi Akiva. Another thing you don't normally see. The Gemara, perhaps aware that we're not so familiar with this Rabbi Chanan ben Pitom, points out, gives you his biography. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva. We never see the Gemara quote Rabbi Meir, Talmido shel Rabbi Akiva. You don't need to tell you that. Everybody knows that Rabbi Meir was Rabbi Akiva's Talmud. But here the Gemara felt it was necessary to point that out. Mishum Rabbi Akiva, and this Hanan ben Pitom, who was a student of Rabbi Akiva, said the following halacha in the name of Rabbi Akiva, which is also interesting because, normally speaking, absent any evidence, any statement of a Talmud is presumed to be representing his Rebbe's opinion. Ein matriin al hadever kol ikar. Rabbi Akiva held, you never, ever sound the alarm for dever, not on Shabbat and not during the week. Now the Gemara goes on, al kol tsara shelo tavo. This is a rabbinic euphemism. On any trouble, it shouldn't come. Right? You have to read it. You'd have to read it in the original Yiddish of the Gemara. Al kol tsara shelo tavo. On any tsaris should not know from it. Right? Meaning, an any tzara that should come, parentheses, chas v'shalom, God forbid, you know, that's a kind of theatrical aside, right? Shalotavo, right? Poo, poo, poo. Al kol tzara, shalotavo, etc. Tanu Rabbanan, al kol tzara, shalotavo, al hatzibur matriyin aleha. On any trouble that comes to the community, you sound the alarm. Chutz mirov gshamim. Except for excessive rain. Why? Because unlike wolves, unlike building collapses, unlike marauding hordes, rain is not inherently bad. How many wolves don't you want wandering around your city? No? How many wolves don't you want in your city? None. You don't want none. You don't want one wolf. You don't want 100 wolves. Right? One wolf is bad. 100 wolves is just 100 times more bad. But one wolf is not a little bit bad. It is bad. How much shidafon do you want in your field? None. Right? It's just a question, like the halacha. Like, how much chilul Shabbos do you want on Shabbos? None. But, you know, still we have to set like a she'ur. We have to set a limit. We don't want any chilul Shabbat. But this chilul Shabbat below that, we're not going to kill you over it. You know, like, you're not allowed to write two otiyot, two letters next to each other. That is the she'ur of chilul Shabbat, of desecrating Sabbath for the malacha of writing. So how many letters are you allowed to write? None. Right? If you write one letter, it's also asur. But you haven't crossed the threshold for which we're going to actually take you out and kill you for it. But you're not allowed to write anything. Right? You're not allowed to write, not allowed to write anything. Right? Right? It's just a question of, like, how much of the Avera do you have to do in order to be susceptible to the punishment? But it doesn't mean that less than the Shi'ur is permitted. So the same thing here. How much wheat needs to be afflicted by the Shidafon before we sound the alarm? Right? So we need to know. We need a Shi'ur. But how much Shidafon would we like to see in our field? Zero. We don't want any of it. We don't want any disease. So Gshamim is not like all these other things. Rain is not only something that we want, but we pray for it. And if we don't get it, we get nervous. But it's, you know, like that grass, you know, the shi'ur of wolves is, you know, a straight line going up. The more wolves, the worse it is. But even one wolf is bad. But the shi'ur of rain is a bell curve. Right? Too little rain is no good. Too much rain is no good. But rain itself is not inherently bad. It's just a question of finding the right proportion. So if you get too much rain, you don't sound the alarm. Why? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, lefi she'ein mitpalim al rov hatova. Because you can't daven against getting too much good. Rain is good, right? Too much rain is not so good. But that doesn't mean that rain itself is bad. V'omer b'yochanan minayin she'ein mitpalin al rov hatova. How do you know this idea that you don't daven against too much of a good thing? Shne'emar heviu et kol ha'maser el beit ha'otzah. This is, we know it from the weddings. This is like a gemara that we know from if you go to a wedding. Heviu et kol ha'maser el beit ha'otzah. It's a pasuk in Malachi. They brought all of the maaser, all of the tithes to the treasury, and there was so much, right? The treasury was doing so well, right? Ad bli dai. Until they said ad bli dai, which colloquially means enough already. So what does it mean, ad bli dai? You know this song, right? La 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 la. Ad bli dai, ad bli dai, 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 dai. Ad shei blusif. Have you been to weddings?
I have a problem. I think of this Gemara when I hear that song.
What?
My problem is I think of this Gemara when I hear that song. It's not such a great song.
It's not such a great song, right? But that's the way Jewish music is. You can take like anything and set it to a jazzy tune, right? And you know, like Lonnie jokes that, you know, like it's surprising no one has set, you know, the Mishnah that we say in Bama Madlikin. Not in Babylon Lincoln, in Peter Maktoret, right? Vahalo me raglayim yafilo, right? Which is a song about like how much urine you can use in the preparation of the incense, right? Or you know that line about like, you know, the wolf excrement, right? Like you could probably dance to that if you get the right tune, right? So, and anyway, people dance to anything. I mean, it's like nobody's paying attention anyway. So, ad bli dai. So, what is ad bli dai? In other words, really, what should it be? In other words, if people are saying, oh, it's so much, dai. Ad dai. In other words, it should be ad until the point where people say, dai, enough. Dai, dai, eno. You remember dai, eno? It's coming up. It's about a month away. Omar Rami Barchama. Ad sheyivlu siftoteche milomar dai. So the Gemara teaches the pasuk to say ad. What is bli dai without enough? Bli doesn't mean enough. Doesn't mean without. Bli means sheyivlu. It's a play on words. This is not ethnologically canon. Sheyivlu means your lips should get worn out from saying enough already. Right, that's what it means. Okay. Omar Amibar Rav Yud, another less familiar name. Uvagola matriina leha. Tanya nami hachi. Shana shig shameha merubin. Anshe mishmar shalchin anshe ma'amad. Tanu einechem ba'achichem shebagola shelo yehe batehem kivrehem. Right? But in chutz la'aretz, you do worry about too much rain. First of all, excessive rain is quite unusual in Eretz Yisrael. Our problem is almost always the opposite. But in chutz la'aretz, that's not the case. Chutz la'aretz here meaning Bavel. Because Bavel, at least the Jewish communities, all those cities that we know about were generally like on like the low-lying areas near the river, like in the valleys. So excessive rain is always dangerous if you're in a valley. If you're in a mountaintop, not so much, but if you're down in a valley, excessive rain is too much. Certainly if the river is going to rise and the rain is going to fall, you're going to really be between a flood and a wet place. So it says, so in a year where there's excessive rain, so the Anshe Mishmar would tell the Anshe Ma'amad, pay attention to the people in the Gola, that their homes do not become their graves, right? We have to worry about the Jews in the diaspora. This is Mashalama Davar Domet, what's happening now in Ukraine. Rachmonos. Shalu at Rabbi Elazar ad Heichan Shamim Yordin v'yitpalu shelo yerdu. So how much rain is excessive rain that you would have to, that in the Gola, you would have to daven that it shouldn't keep raining? So Omar lehem, kedei shiyamod adam bekeren ofel v'yishachshech raglav b'mayim. It's some kind of cliff. I don't know exactly where it is, although I presume somebody has researched this. It's a cliff, right? And far down below the cliff is the river. But if you're sitting on the cliff's edge in Keren Ophel and you can dangle your feet and they can get into the water, that means there's too much water. Vahatanya yadav. But he says that maybe it means you can't put your hands in the water. Raglav ki yadav kamina. So it means your hands and your water. Like you're sitting on the cliff's edge and your feet and your hands, you dangle over and you hang. I don't know. I mean, we don't know where this Keren Ophel is. We don't know how far it was from Keren Ophel down to the river. But Rashi says, Rashi, who certainly didn't know where Keren Ophel was or how high it was above the Pnei Hayam, the water surface, Keren Ophel, a Shein Sela Gavoa, the Kachshmo, a kind of overhanging rock cliff, rock face, and it was very high. Omar Rabba Barchana Lididi Chazyali Keren Ophel. He says, I once saw this place. Tekam Hahu Taya Kirachiv Gamla. I saw a certain Arab riding on a camel. Venokit Romcha Bidei Mitchazei Iniva. I was once at the top. You know, it's like, you know what this makes me think of? It's like the Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner, right? You know, he's always up on the cliff. He's looking down. So he says, I was once there and I looked down. And I was on top and down below there was an Arab on a donkey and he was carrying a spear in his hands. And he looked to me about as big as a worm. He was like an ant, like a grass. I was like nothing. So that makes it sound like it was up very high, right? So that's a lot of rain. It would have to rain a lot in order to cause it. But if you ever see like those videos of the flash floods, like down near the Dead Sea, down near Ein Gedi, right? You can find them on YouTube. These videos of the flash floods. You can see that sometimes, like up there, like on these tall, high, rocky mountainside, you know, the amount of the water comes in and fills up the whole gorge, the whole wadi. Right, so you can see that it really can get very high. The Gemara says, "Tnu Rabbanan v'natati gishmechem b'itam." I will give the rain in the right time. Lo, you know what? I apologize. I have to go now to get to Mariv. So we're going to pause here, and we will continue next week after Purim. So sober up by next Tuesday, I will continue on Tuesday. Freilich in Purim.
Thank you.
Bez ładnych sztampów.